The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello and welcome to ILTV Zion News and the Blaze Radio Network. Coming up in today's newscast, a massive barrage of Gaza rockets injures at least 11 Israeli citizens. The nation-state law faces its first true legal tests. And here's something I never thought I'd be saying. Israel might have a massive crocodile crisis on its hands.
The situation along the Gaza border has exploded into one of the most volatile in years. Palestinian terrorists in the Strip have launched more than 180 rockets into Israeli territory over the last 24 hours, with several successfully striking civilian communities in Israel. At least 30 rockets were intercepted by the Iron Dome, and over 173 red alert sirens have been sounded across the Eshkol regional councils, Be'er Sheva, Sderot, and more. At this time, an estimated 11 Israelis have been injured, including one who remains in serious condition. 13 more are being treated for shock and trauma.
For many, the writing is on the wall. This is by and far the most explosive situation since the 2014 Gaza War, Operation Protective Edge. The army is reportedly considering taking similar measures now in this case as well, circling a possible full-scale operation in Gaza. Others speculate that this may merely be a last-ditch display of strength by Hamas amidst talk of potential ceasefire, as if to demonstrate that Hamas isn't entering a deal on account of any weakness. On the other hand, of course, this kind of violence will only result in an appropriate IDF response. The army has lustily pounded more than 140 Hamas targets within the Strip in reaction to this latest barrage, leaving three Gazans dead, allegedly including a pregnant Palestinian woman and a child. At this time, rocket sirens continue to blare in southern Israeli communities, sending tens of thousands of Israelis to the bomb shelters throughout the night. Top Israeli leadership has convened an emergency meeting to weigh Israel's next response. Though a Hamas delegation is in Cairo right now to discuss finalizing a ceasefire with Israel, that possibility seems like the furthest thing from anyone's mind as rockets continue to launch towards the country.
Returning now to the studio with more on the unfolding events around Gaza in the south is founder and executive director of the Israel Institute for Strategic Studies, Dr. Martin Sherman. Dr. Sherman, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me again.
All right, so my first question, let's start. You know, why now? Why is this happening now amid ceasefire talks?
Well, you know, I think the question of why is, you know, why not now? Because I think the real problem with Gaza is not an operational one, but a conceptual one. And I think that as long as Israel is bound by the hope, or at least the illusion, that somewhere down the line, the Palestinians will become a prospective peace partner rather than an implacable enemy, is what is impeding Israeli policy. Because you need to break away from conventional wisdom. We need to find ways to permanently eradicate this violence. And the only way that you can control what happens in Gaza, when it happens, and what emerges from Gaza, is if you take control of Gaza.
Well, okay, so might some of these attacks, and again, I'm playing devil's advocate here, but might some of these attacks be out of Hamas's control? Perhaps it's militants who are just kind of doing things and Hamas is not directing that action? Or is this maybe a last-ditch effort to show strength of some sort?
Does that matter? But that doesn't really matter. It's irrelevant. As I said before, the only way that you can control what happens in Gaza is if you control it. And the only way that you can control Gaza without ruling another people is by launching a large international initiative to remove the non-belligerent population from that area and help them be resettled and rehabilitated in third-party countries out of the clutch of the cruel, corrupt cliques who've led them from disaster to disaster for the last number of decades, almost 100 years. And anything else is merely delaying it. You know, what worries me is this policy of restraint, because we had a situation last night when almost a whole playground of children were the victims of constraint. It just was a matter of good fortune that the rocket that fell a little further away. And, you know, whilst Israel has been exercising constraint, The Hamas have been enhancing their capabilities, improving their rockets, their payroll, their payload, their range, excavating tunnels, developing naval forces, devising incendiary kites, and now even drone capabilities. So, you know, and unless for some unknown reason you think the Palestinians are going to morph into something that they haven't been for the last 100 years, and so no signs of morphing into in the near future, you need to understand that they are not prospective peace partners, but implacable enemies.
All right, so it is looking with, you know, with the casualties and injuries on the Israeli side, it's looking more and more likely that there will be a ground invasion or some sort of ground force that will go into Gaza. It's looking very possible that a war is on our hands, first time since 2014. What would a war with the current, you know, because you've said what you wish would happen, but with Israel's current policies and current leadership, what would a war in Gaza look like?
Well, you know, and unless you have far-reaching end goals, it's just going to be a rerun of the same. And unfortunately, what I think, you know, unless people realize that you have to control Gaza from within, you're going to have a situation where you're either going to have Arabs in Gaza or Jews in the Negev, but you won't have both, because one or two more rounds of violence like this, more fields being destroyed, more rockets falling near kindergartens, people are not going to stay there because the government isn't providing them with the kind of protection that they deserve. And the only way to do that is to neutralize the hostile forces in Gaza. The only way to neutralize the hostile forces in Gaza is to take Gaza and keep Gaza. Because, you know, when we pulled out of Gaza, we handed it over to the Palestinian Authority with Yasser Arafat. It quickly reverted to Islamic control by Hamas. And there's no reason to think that this is going to change direction.
All right, so my final question is, if there isn't maybe a change in this kind of end goal, or perhaps let's assume that there is an end goal, because we've heard oftentimes from Israeli leadership that the next war in Gaza will be the last one.
What does that mean? The only way the next war will be the last war is if Israel takes over Gaza and
Do you see them doing that? Do you see that happening?
What's the alternative? You know, and the trouble is, you know, obviously it's easy for me to sit here in an air-conditioned studio and advocate large-scale military action, but that doesn't mean to say it's not necessary. What are you going to do? We've already had at least three campaigns in the south, time and time again, and at the end of each campaign, there's been a period of calm, which the other side has exploited to enhance its capabilities and emerge with enhanced status. What will be the point of another military action now, unless you have some kind of permanent aim in mind?
All right, well, it's leaving us with a lot to think of, obviously. Dr. Sherman, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Now, Israel's recent nation-state law still remains a controversial topic. People against it say that it minimizes minorities in Israel to the status of second-class citizens, but people for it say that it merely enshrines the country's Jewish identity into its founding basic laws, and that it won't change much in Israel anyway. Well, we now may be looking at the very first cases in which the nation-state law will, in fact, prove to be a deciding precedent in Israeli policy.
A lawyer from the state's attorney's office named Harel Arnon has gone on record now, saying that the nation-state law will definitely be used by the government for some changes. Arnon told reporters that the regulation law concerning the legalization of Jewish homes in Palestinian-owned territory will be one such change. Citing the provision that puts Jewish settlement as a top national issue, this is kind of a strategy to aggressively ramp up Israeli seizure and annexation of Palestinian-owned properties. In perhaps related news, Israel has also just announced that it will triple the size of land being used to relocate evacuees from the illegally built Amona outpost in the occupied West Bank. A legal battle is likely to follow, but the nation-state law's first true test may be much more imminent concerning a different case. An Arab-Israeli Knesset member in the Joint List Party submitted his letter of resignation to Yudi Edelstein yesterday. The resignation was part of a pre-agreed-upon rotation within the Joint List Party for the cycling of MKs. But when Edelstein received the letter in Arabic, he reportedly refused to sign it because it was written in a language he didn't understand. The new nation-state law essentially downgraded Arabic from a national language alongside Hebrew to a language with special status. Legally, a resignation cannot be finalized unless accepted by Edelstein's signature as the Knesset speaker. Edelstein forwarded the letter to the translation department and signed a version translated to Hebrew. Other Arab MKs are also now threatening to submit their resignations in Arabic in protest of the new law, and President Rivlin has apparently planned to sign the final script of the nationality law in Arabic as well, as a symbolic protest against the legislation. Needless to say, this is all evidence of further debate yet to come.
Recently, we reported on new evidence about the Russian-led campaign to use social media to influence the outcome of the 2016 United States presidential election. Well, a shocking new investigation into similar networks here in Israel has exposed what could be yet another massive organized network of fake bot accounts. For now, it's unknown who is exactly running this campaign, but what is clear is that the fake accounts follow a similar pattern and have been used to spread misinformation to the Israeli public concerning internal political issues.
This discovery is the work of an Israeli security investigator and activist named Noam Rotem. Rotem first began analyzing accounts that seemed fake or just weird based on strange comments, activity, and social media patterns. While scouring and researching hundreds of accounts, he identified several that seemed to follow almost identical patterns, which could suggest an elaborate, though perhaps amateur, orchestration by a single group. Those accounts typically pretended to be attractive young women, sometimes even IDF soldiers. Further, the accounts would post pictures of Israeli vistas with carefully crafted Shabbat Shalom messages, implying a fierce national pride for the state of Israel, sometimes with a few bikini pictures mixed in for good measure. But the big red flag for Rotem was that the accounts bounced off of other accounts within the fake bot network, driving up their traffic and spreading them to real users. Real people would then see the high number of retweets and assume that they were not only real, but potentially quite expert. Well, at this point, the accounts would then post misleading or even outright false reports targeting Israel's left-wing politics. The resulting echo chamber began a widespread push of fake reports in favor of Israel's right wing. For example, some accounts successfully distributed a forged WhatsApp conversation, which was made to imply collaboration between the Druze and Israel's Labor Party over criticisms of Israel's new nation-state law. Other conspiracy theories included accusations that the left wing was funding protests against the right wing. For now, we don't know who's behind the pushing of these buttons, but given the deep recesses of the internet, we could very well be looking at just the tip of the iceberg.
For a country known as one of the most innovative tech hubs in the world, Israel has often been accused of having some really bad infrastructure on its own home turf. Chief among those complaints, painfully slow internet speeds. Well, as it turns out, Israel's internet speeds are indeed pretty bad compared to the rest of the world, and unfortunately, they're actually getting worse.
I know what you're thinking. How is it possible that a country which consistently tops tech innovation lists has such bad internet? Well, the reason why is actually pretty simple. It's mostly just plain economics. There are only two primary companies in Israel that provide major internet infrastructure, Bezeq and Hot. When you apply the laws of supply and demand, that means that there's not much competition to drive up quality nor drive down prices. And unfortunately, it's the Israeli innovators themselves who suffer the consequences most, along with everyone else who uses the World Wide Web for anything. In a new report, Israel now ranks 70th out of 200 nations surveyed. Israel was 60th on the same list last year, not a promising sign. But how slow is slow? Well, let's say you wanted to download an episode of your favorite new TV series in full HD. In Israel, a 90-minute episode might take you something like an hour and 30 minutes to download. In Singapore, you'd have done it in under 12 minutes. What the country needs is a slick upgrade of fiber optic cables. Unfortunately, the Knesset has noted a massive decrease in infrastructure funding for stuff like this over the years, leaving Israel increasingly behind in the fast-moving digital world of smartphones, smart TVs, and even smart fridges.
As you may know, old diesel-based cars and trucks account for the vast majority of the pollution from vehicles, and that's why nations around the world are doing all that they can to get these vehicles off the road entirely. Well, Israel's just come up with an idea that diesel owners are probably going to love. They're offering a cash reward to people who are willing to give up their gas guzzlers and send them to the scrap heap. So here's how the breakdown works. This offer applies to any diesel-driven car, truck, or bus from 2000 until 2005. For example, a 9-passenger minibus is worth a 5,000 shekel government grant. But if you've got an old truck or a bus that weighs in the neighborhood of 12 tons, you're looking at closer to 22,000 shekels. And that's roughly $6,000. Now, toxic fumes from diesel engines make up 80% of Israel's air pollution from vehicles, and that is a huge amount, considering that only a fifth of all trips made in Israel are done on the backs of a diesel engine. But a lot of Israelis rely on their old gas guzzlers for their businesses, like private delivery companies, tour guides, etc. So if they want to hold on to their cars, well, they'll need to get a particle filter installed by September 1st in order to comply with new transportation laws. But good news, the Ministry of Environmental Protection, which is offering the cash trade-in, is also offering to cover the entire installation cost of the filter, just as long as the vehicle and the driver meet all the legal criteria. In the quest for cleaner roads and air, this offer is a long time coming, and hopefully it'll be a breath of fresh air. Another day, another incredible discovery by archaeologists here in Israel. Israel's Antiquities Authority has just announced an impressive find, a rare 2,000-year-old gold earring. This small but valuable artifact was found in the City of David National Park, just outside the gates of Jerusalem's Old City. As you can see, the earring is shaped kind of like the horns of an animal, maybe a deer or a ram or an antelope. And if you look closely, you can make out the creature's eyes and open mouth, almost like an action pose. Now, as you might also see, this tiny treasure is forged from solid gold, an element that even 2,000 years ago signaled massive wealth and elite status.
To find something of gold in an excavation is amazing because gold doesn't oxidize. It's as pure as it is when it was left. If you find bronze objects, iron objects, you find rust, and you find things that are completely oxidized, you don't see. And when the guy who excavated it, you know, just lifted it, it was just as clean as it's now in my hands. So everybody says, gold, okay, for the first time. Second, after you see that it's a jewelry, it's also amazing. And third, when you start all these questions you ask me, so what does it say about Jerusalem? What does it say about the person who lives here? And so on. Then the machine of archaeology begins to work.
Now, as always, the place where the artifact was discovered is almost as important as the artifact itself. This discovery was just made in a dig outside of the Old City of Jerusalem, and considering it may be the only one of its kind ever found there, it opens up a world of connections that could illuminate the history of ancient Jerusalem. It most likely comes from the 3rd century BCE, during the Hellenistic period, and if you're wondering who wore it, well, that's an even bigger mystery than you might know. Back then, as in now, both men and women would have worn earrings like these.
First of all, we don't know if it's a man or a woman, because in antiquity, you see in the movies, it can be a man, it can be a woman. Also today. And the second thing is that it's a variety of identities. It can be somebody of Greek origin living here in Jerusalem, but it can be a more Hellenized Jew. And I'll be very surprised, but it's still possible. I don't know of a specific rule against this, that this would be a conservative Jewish at that time.
Well, here's another major entry in sports history for you. Israeli runner Lona Chemtai Salpeter has just snagged the gold in the 10,000-meter run at this year's European Athletics Championship, the first runner ever to do so in Israeli history.
Now, if her name sounds familiar, there's a good reason for that. Salpeter actually won the world-renowned Tel Aviv Marathon back in 2016, with a time that earned her a spot on Israel's marathon team for the 2016 Summer Olympics. Halfway into her Olympic debut, Salpeter was in the top half of the pack, but regrettably had to drop out before finishing due to a shoulder problem. Well, clearly she's back in action and claiming gold medals like it's no one's business. She won first at the Euro Championship by a good 9 seconds over the second place finisher, which is a sizable margin in the world of 10,000-meter races. Salpeter's personal story is also worthy of a gold medal. Originally born in a small village in western Kenya, she came to Israel in 2008 by chance, working as a nanny to Kenya's ambassador to Israel. She was practicing her run on the track one day and happened to catch the eye of Israeli running coach Dan Salpeter. He took her under his wing and started coaching her. Oh, and by the way, they got married a few years later. By then, she'd already been seeking Israeli citizenship for years, though. And even after her marriage to an Israeli, the government refused to grant her the status. But shortly after qualifying for the Olympics, the state suddenly approved her application for citizenship, allowing her to compete for the state of Israel. She and her husband now live with their young son Roy in a moshav in central Israel. Our bets are on this amazing woman, and here's to many more gold medals to come.
And now we turn to ILTV's Emmanuel Kadosh with this week's Top 5.
Jewish and Israeli architects have been creating unique and fascinating buildings since the very founding of the State of Israel. Well, I'm here to give you guys ILTV's list of the top 5 Jewish and Israeli architects and show you some of their works. fifth on our list is the architect responsible for creating Israel's first mall, Dizengoff Center, Yitzhak Yashal. Along with the shopping center, which has most of Tel Aviv's traffic running through it, Yashal also designed the Tel Aviv Museum of Art, the Facility of Arts building at the Tel Aviv University, and many more. Yashal Architects has become one of Israel's leading firms for a perfect combo of mixed-use buildings and urban designs. Fourth up is the one and only David Azrieli, best known here in Israel for the Azrieli Center, which is three towers of different shapes that has, in a way, become one of the symbols of Tel Aviv. Most of the center is occupied by offices, as well as huge shopping mall at the bottom. The train even has a stop that places you right at the Azrieli Center, so getting there is more convenient than ever. Third up on the list is Ziv Rechter, known to have designed some of Israel's most iconic buildings and considered to be one of the three founding fathers of Israeli architecture, along with the next on the list. Rechter designed the International Convention Center, the Tel Aviv Courthouse, and many more. He also worked alongside fellow architects to build the Mann Auditorium in Tel Aviv. Second is another founding father of Israeli architecture, along with Rechter, Dov Kalmi. Along with co-designing the Mann Auditorium with Rechter, located at the Habima Square in Tel Aviv, Kalmi also helped during the 9-year planning process of the Israeli Knesset building, along with his son Rami. Dov was awarded the Israeli Prize for Architecture in 1957. Later in 2002, his son Rami was awarded the same prize, and then 5 years after that, his daughter won the award as well. You could say this is a family of many brilliant architects, to say the least. First on our list is one of my personal favorites, Pizzo Kedem. His talent, bringing the old work into the new. Kedem has worked on historical houses in the ancient city of Yafo, along with the renovation of the former apartment of the first prime minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion. My favorite aspect of Kedem's work is his modern, fine-line, clean styles that help make any place look like $1 million. Hopefully, he'll be designing my future home. That's all for today's Top 5. Back to you.
Thank you so much, Emmanuel, for that. For this week's Top 5. The architecture looks incredible. But now moving on, here's something I never thought that I would ever have to say. Israel has a potential crocodile crisis on the horizon. Don't worry, we're not talking about croc-infested waters just yet. But for now, an Israeli man in the West Bank has literally hundreds of crocs on his hands, just sitting in his backyard, and he has no idea what to do with them.
So, how did an army of crocodiles wind up in the Holy Land in the first place? Well, back in the mid-90s, the Israeli settlement of Petzael in the West Bank thought that a crocodile zoo would make for a killer tourist attraction. Not literally, of course, but needless to say, the idea never truly took off. An Israeli businessman named Gadi Biton ended up buying them, thinking he could make a pretty penny by selling them off for their skin. His solution hit a snag, though, when he realized that crocodiles are a protected animal. So no, you can't skin them, and you can't sell them for food either. So long story short, the crocs have been sunbathing in the Jordan Valley for the last several years. And not just sunbathing. Crocs are notoriously quick breeders. So over the decades, those dozens have multiplied into hundreds, which could become thousands pretty soon. And here's where the story takes a very scary twist. Twice now, some of the crocs have actually managed to escape their boundaries, nearly finding their way into international waters. One time, 70 escaped at once, and it took teams 3 days to track them all down. I think by now it goes without saying that one man's headache could quickly become a regional crisis if even one croc managed to find its way into mainstream waters. But to be honest, no one's quite sure exactly how to solve this crisis just yet. And the idea of croc-infested waters all over Israel is exactly the opposite of what we need right now. The Hebrew Word of the Day is brought to you by IDC Summer Ulpan, open to everyone.
Now for our Hebrew Word of the Day. If you saw our last story about a crocodile farm gone horribly, horribly wrong, then you understand why I now have crocodiles in my nightmares, and you'll also know why today's word is tanin, which means crocodile. So instead of telling you all the terrifying things about the tanin or the crocodile, I'm going to tell you some nice fun things. All right, so first, a tanin can actually live as long as most humans, sometimes up to about 70 years. Here's another cool thing. Despite all those sharp teeth, a tanin actually doesn't even chew its food. It kind of just swallows stuff whole and then eats rocks to help grind up the food in their stomachs. Insane. And three, the tanin as a species predates man by millions of years. In fact, taninim, or crocodiles, even roamed the earth right alongside the dinosaurs. Pretty awesome. Talk about apex predators. Now let's go ahead and take a look at the weather forecast. Tonight should be clear to partly cloudy and warm with a low of 78 or 26 degrees Celsius. Then over the weekend, you can expect hot and sunny days with highs around 90 or 32 degrees Celsius.